Welcome to MuggleCast, your weekly ride into the Wizarding World fandom. I'm Andrew.
I'm Eric.
And I'm Micah.
We are joined once again by our social media manager, Chloe. Hey, Chloe, welcome back.
Hey, boys. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. We're missing Laura this week, but we're glad you are here.
I know. Maybe one day Laura and I will finally do a MuggleCast together.
Oh, no. Okay, we do have to fix that. I didn't realize that it's the last time you were
on. It's okay. Laura and I can just be in love off air.
And thank you for all that awesome coverage of our birthday that you did on our social media channels. It was all so good.
So much fun. So much fun looking through old pictures of y'all. And everyone really loved it. I mean, the nostalgia factor is real.
Year 17 begins now.
You're adults in the wizarding world.
Yes, of wizarding age. I think you actually noticed that for us. So thank you for realizing that.
A little pat on the back. Gold star.
So we did do that Quizzitch Live last week, and that was last week's episode of the show. And it was MuggleCast themed in honor of our birthday. And we also announced at the end of it, in case you haven't listened to that episode, that Chapter by Chapter is coming back to MuggleCast.
Woo-hoo!
It'll be launching in probably the middle of September. We still have a bunch of episodes we want to do before we get back into Chapter by Chapter, but we are going to be going in order for the first time, which is going to be great. We're going to move a little bit faster through the earlier books, but then as things start getting darker and more twisted, or just more complicated in the story, we'll slow down to one chapter per episode. So everybody was really excited by this news, so it's made us even more excited about it. And again, that'll be kicking off in September.
Everyone's so excited on socials. Everyone is like, yes, I've been waiting for this.
It's been a long requested thing that we go back, especially to the early books. And when we were doing chapter by chapter of books 5 and 6 most recently, there was also an additional push going, well, like, this is really awesome now that you guys are adults and have this new perspective. So go back, do it. And yeah, we were waiting for the right time, but this is the right time.
This is the right time. And like 3 weeks after we start it, we're going to hear like new Harry Potter TV series launches next week.
Yeah.
Fantastic Beasts 4. It's a go.
And we already shot it.
Totally derail us. Yeah.
So anyway, we're all looking forward to that. But this week, we're having a main discussion that was actually inspired by a very popular thread in the Harry Potter subreddit. And thank you to millennial co-host Pam, whose brother actually suggested to us that we do this for an episode. What did a character that is considered good do that rubbed you the wrong way in the Harry Potter series?
I love this topic. This is a great topic.
Yeah.
You know, we talk a lot about the bad characters of Harry Potter. Let's talk about the good ones. It's kind of neat because not everybody is all good or all bad.
And by the way, I just mentioned Millennial. That's a show that Laura and I co-host. And by the way, Chloe runs the social media channels for that. No, but I wanted to mention it because Eric was actually on 2-3 weeks ago and we had a great discussion with him. So check out that episode if you want to get more of us.
I was thrilled to be on the show after all this time.
But everybody check that out, millennialshow.com. And while we're promoting podcasts, Micah was recently on Eric's podcast too.
Yes, Micah's appearance kicked off season 2 of Thank You for Spieling podcast, and the interview went so well, the convo went so great that we broke it into 2 parts. Both are now available. Definitely go check it out. Thank You for Spieling is my personal podcast. I've had a number of friends on talking about some interesting and topical things, mostly very nostalgic things as well. So if you're a fan of that sort of thing, definitely give a look at the other episode topics. One of the episodes had my mom on it. The other episode had a recording of me as a 9-year-old. So it really varies. But I was really grateful that Micah and I were able to talk about the time that I've never asked him about before, which was, what did he do before MuggleCast? What was young Micah like?
You have to tune in and find out.
Check out both shows. We love doing MuggleCast, but we love talking about things outside of Harry Potter as well. So check out those shows.
Yeah.
But anyway, getting back to today's Harry Potter discussion, this Reddit thread, here's how this is going to go. So each of us brought a character to the table today. Maybe some of our points were at least partly inspired by the Reddit thread, because the Reddit thread got a ton of responses. But we all came to the table also with just our own thoughts on the situation. So we're going to discuss each of these characters. So, Eric, do you want to kick things off today?
Yeah, you know, I thought of Molly Weasley first as being a character who is largely good. The Potter series is all about a mother's love. And
give it up for Molly Weasley.
Ladies and gentlemen, Molly Weasley.
That's a throwback.
Mikey B returning to MuggleCast, hopefully in the weeks ahead.
Oh, that's going to be great.
He coined that line.
But yes, give it up for Molly. I will say she's the series, you know, she's Harry's mother figure. Harry does not have his mother. Lily, unfortunately, died when he was very young. And so Molly's what we get as far as maybe a, you know, would-be motherly figure.
It's always warmed my heart to see her looking out for Harry. Obviously has been in his corner for the most part since the beginning.
And she like knits him a sweater.
Yeah.
Each year. It's a wonderful thing.
All right. Enough of this good stuff.
So what she did to Sirius is inexcusable, and what she did to Fleur and Hermione throughout the books is totally inexcusable.
Yes.
I've often said that book five is really this whole smear campaign against Sirius Black. I find that he did not have a good last year of his life, but this was complicated by these arguments that we would be privy to at Grimmauld Place between Molly and Sirius over what is best for Harry. Now, Harry at that time is not of age like MuggleCast is. He could not make these decisions for himself. So Molly would very much be vocal about how she felt. And Sirius would, I think, be more of lackadaisical, like Harry's an adult. Sirius is more likely to treat Harry as though his wishes were totally legit and anything he should want to do, he should be able to do. And Molly was a little bit more protective. There's nothing bad in that inherently, except I think that because of who she was working with, Molly tended to overcompensate in that area of protection and didn't often take into account what Harry might actually want. And I think that as a parent, you kind of have to toe a fine line between the needs of you as a parent and, you know, keeping your child safe versus actually guiding them and allowing them to kind of explore things that they want to do with their lives.
Sirius didn't have a choice to be absent from Harry's life. I think this was a point that Molly was bringing up. And Sirius also just got out of prison. It's like, you got to give him a break. She should also know that Sirius and James had a very close relationship. Mm. They were great friends. And that is an excellent reason on its own for Sirius to be Harry's godfather.
My heart just broke a little, because you're right. I mean, if anyone can father Harry the way that James would have wanted, it's probably Sirius. We just don't see him sort of channeling James in these moments, because they're all sort of, they tend to be heated moments where it all has to do with official order business. So they're still in all of this business with destroying Voldemort that it never really gets as personal as it could. But very quickly, Sirius is written off as just putting Harry in harm's way because he thinks he's James. And I just don't think that that's necessarily fair.
I think, though, that part of this is Molly feeling threatened. And we're going to talk about that with Fleur as well. Mm. With Sirius, I think it's from that parental guidance standpoint. Now, obviously, Sirius doesn't have a whole lot of experience there. But given the fact that he was best friends with James, he does have direct ties to the Potter family. Mrs. Weasley looks at Harry as being one of her own, and it's almost like she may feel a bit threatened, right? Harry is the godson. Sirius, for all we know, if he doesn't end up dying at the end of Order of the Phoenix, Harry was going to come live with him, right? We hear that at the end of Prisoner of Azkaban. I just think that she feels threatened on some level, and that's why she reacts the way that she does. Maybe not in full. There's a irresponsibility factor to Sirius, certainly, but I also think he deserves a bit of a pass.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think that Molly is defensive in this. She's on the defensive in this situation when it comes to Sirius. And also, Molly does have her moments of like what we would call a helicopter parent, especially when it comes to Harry in this moment. But Molly is a wonderful mom overall, But it does make me think of, you know, as you become an adult, you have sometimes this moment where you suddenly realize that your parents are just people too, not people that you idolize and people that are flawed and make mistakes just like anyone else. And I think that that's what's happened to my view of Molly. I think I idolized her growing up reading the books. I was like, oh my gosh, she's the perfect mom. And I want Molly Weasley to be my mom. And, you know, sometimes I still do, but it became a moment where I was like, wait a minute, she's flawed as well. And she has her own trauma to deal with. And sometimes that, you know, translates to how she treats her children. And it's all about like breaking, you know, a cycle of how her mom treated her and how she treats her kids. So I think that Molly Weasley is that flawed, wonderful mom that, you know, you can love, but realize that she doesn't do it right all the time.
And that's okay.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I jumped right into the Sirius Black, how Molly harmed Sirius or harmed Harry by being mean to Sirius. But I think on the whole, she caused a lot more harm to some other members of her family, including her daughter-in-law, Fleur, and also Hermione. So we're going to talk about that. There's a post on Reddit from user 24601 that I think sums it up beautifully. It says, the situation with her and Fleur that's getting talked about a lot has an explanation where Molly discusses how many people got married fast during Voldemort's last rise to power, including herself and Arthur. And so now Bill and Fleur are getting married after, what, a year of actually knowing each other? So she says she's worried that they're running into something based on lust rather than love, which is probably made worse by the fact that Fleur is part Vila. Molly probably has friends who wound up in unhappy marriages because they rushed into it with no thought for tomorrow, because tomorrow didn't seem likely with Voldemort on the rise, and she doesn't want her child in that same boat. However, I would say it's kind of a bit hypocritical, more than a little bit, to be saying you're rushing into this marriage because her children, who are both adults, or Bill and Fleur at this point, are adults. They've moved away from home. They have their own jobs, need to be able to make their own decisions. The kind of behavior that Molly is exhibiting towards Fleur and getting basically all of the Burrow to shun Fleur for because she doesn't like her is very much a different thing altogether than just talking about some concerns I have about you rushing into your relationship.
And I think the other problem is that it's outward.
Mm.
If she kept it to herself or maybe just spoke about it at night with Arthur, then okay, that's understandable. That's what you do as parents or siblings. You gossip about the different relationships happening in the family or, yeah, some pillow talk. The problem comes in when it's noticeable that she doesn't like Fleur and she doesn't like Bill's decision here. I, just to play devil's advocate, will say, like, I get where Molly's coming from in terms of people rushing into marriages. Sometimes people do that, or relationships. And I would prefer that some people slow down. Clearly, it worked out for Bill and Fleur. So I guess we can't really fault them. And Molly does eventually come around to Fleur. But yeah, I think it was very inappropriate how she was letting other people know her disappointment in this whole situation.
Yeah.
I go back to this episode that we did of MuggleCast number 383, and it was from our Half-Blood Prince chapter by chapter analysis. The title of the episode is She Existed, and the question answered or asked was, what did Fleur do to deserve this from Molly?
Yeah.
She existed.
Just to go back to something Chloe mentioned earlier when talking about Molly, she is a bit of a helicopter parent, and this is her first son that's getting married. I think there's something to be said for that, in that this is her baby, regardless of the fact that there's many other Weasleys. He's going out, he's getting married. There's always that level of judgment of that, in this case, female counterpart that will be replacing her in his life. I think there's a bit of that going on with Molly.
Yeah, no one's ever going to be good enough for her boy. And the first one.
I mean, would she apply this level of scrutiny to like any dragon that Charlie brought home to dinner? I mean, come on, I don't.
Slightly different.
I just don't think
so.
There's
layers.
Right?
Like, I have such strong feelings about this. I was waiting for y'all to like get your feelings out. But Fleur is like, it drives me crazy. I have such a soft spot for her for obvious reasons, I feel like. But
Chloe's French.
I'm French and blonde and I like love Fleur so much. But
and Vila.
Yeah. And Vila. Molly's treatment of Fleur is like, honestly, the beginning especially is like nightmare future mother-in-law situation, in my opinion. It feels like she's trying to scare Fleur away. And I totally get what you're saying, Andrew, about like the rushing into things. But Molly did it first. And that's the part that's like super hypocritical of her. Like Molly rushed into a relationship with Arthur and marriage during the first Wizarding War. So why can't her son do the same thing? And like, it's not that Fleur is just a pretty face. She's also badass. Like it's she's talented and smart and she has her own job. And I think that she is painting Fleur out to be superficial when I do think she has, Fleur is not perfect. She has rude tendencies sometimes and she can be vain, you know, the Vila thing, but she cares and loves Bill and that's super evident. And it's harmful what Molly is doing. There's also the like British French thing, which we could talk about, but British people don't like French people and French people don't like British people. And that's like literally cultural. So there also could be some of that going on. And the Vila thing as well. Like she's not completely human and Molly isn't perfect. There might be some prejudice there as well. Fleur would be an awesome daughter-in-law, in my personal opinion.
Well, something that we don't focus enough on, and to be fair, nobody's really sticking up for Fleur. I will apologize, Chloe, because the way you're saying her name is beautiful, and I'm sure it's 100% perfect. But I could never recreate that, so I apologize. Listeners at home, I'm sorry I can't say Fleur.
It's pretentious if I say Fleur, and it's pretentious if I say Fleur, so there's no good option. So
but so I used to say Fleur or Floor, and Ooh. Is it better if I just say Fleur?
Yeah, that one. Okay. Not Fleur.
I'm gonna go. I'm settling okay, on Fleur. Fleur.
I probably said Fleur.
Yeah.
Fleur.
Okay. We're gonna train ourselves. Okay. but it's not pointed out that Fleur was her school's Triwizard champ. Yeah, you know, this was the Beauxbatons. Do you like how I tried to do the Beauxbatons?
That was good.
Thank you very much. I'm learning. She was her school's champion. She was presumably the person with the purest heart and the most badassery from that entire country's representation of the Wizarding World. That is not at all a consideration that Molly has ever seemingly taken into consideration. When we actually look at her performance in the Triwizard Cup, there's a lot of tasks for which she kind of makes some unfortunate mistakes and is not, but like this character assassination of Fleur, which is made worse by Molly's just assuming she's out there to, I don't know, tempt Bill away and doesn't have his best interests at heart.
Yeah.
It's just this long going thing that is just completely unfounded. Mm-hmm. And Fleur needs to go and basically tackle another dragon, you know, at the end of the book by still showing her love for Bill after he's been attacked and mutilated in order for Molly to approve of her. And I'm just saying the barrier shouldn't be that high. Bill loves her. Bill is infatuated by her, but that should be enough at least to prevent the kind of behavior that we see at the beginning of Half-Blood Prince.
Right. And let us not forget that at Beauxbatons, they're a male and female school. And the movie is like, I'll never forgive Goblet of Fire for doing that, because Fleur was the best champion at a school where there was both genders, not just at a school where there was just women. And it paints her almost in the way that like, oh, she only got it because it was an all-female school. And that's not the truth. She was just the best witch, period. And that is really frustrating to me as well, that that's not recognized more.
I think that we'll conclude Molly for now. We know that she does come around to Fleur eventually. So I think that, you know, nobody's perfect. On the whole, she's a good character, but those were her flaws.
Well said. And I'm enjoying this because we don't have to like defend her necessarily or these other characters that we're going to be speaking about today.
No.
It's time to criticize.
That's what we're here for.
Well, also, listen, just as like a complete side note, this whole like Fleur Molly thing is, again, the author demonizing femininity for God knows what reason. But she does that a lot.
That's a recurring thing.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so Micah, who do you have for us?
I think it's fair to say with Dumbledore that he is a beloved character. He's a good guy, but he also has his fair share of flaws, most of which come to the surface in Deathly Hallows, most of which are in the life and lies of Albus Dumbledore. We really get to see his true nature when Harry goes to the Pensieve and is able to look at Snape's memories. Pig for Slaughter comes to mind. But what I really thought about with Dumbledore, and this goes back to how we always talk about Hogwarts being a security nightmare, he puts his students in danger year after year, particularly with the Defense Against the Dark Arts position. He knows the position is cursed. And you would think that as a result of that, he would have strict criteria. He would vet the position accordingly. You'd also expect he would keep a pretty close eye on that professor year after year. Now, maybe not in year one. You give him a pass.
Right. It's a mistake. Mistakes happen.
Year two is kind of pushing it. But by year three, now, of course, he was aware of Lupin's condition. But yeah, if we just start at the very beginning, let's start with Quirrell. He's given this position. He comes back from Albania. He now has a turban atop his head. Okay, maybe he's making some changes in his life. We can
style choices.
Live with that. Religious changes, we can live with that.
Uh-huh.
But now at the end, I say, let's give him a pass year one. It's revealed that Voldemort, the darkest wizard of all time, is hanging out on the back of this professor's head.
Time to shut it down. Time to learn from our mistakes.
You could have started a new course with a very similar name, and it would have solved the entire problem.
Oh, that's true. Well, for me, I don't even agree with calling it year one, because the position has been cursed ever since adult Voldemort came by and asked for the job, and that was before Harry was born. So this is easily year 12, year 13, year 14 of a Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher not making it. And in each of Harry's cases, they have serious ill will against him. Or in the case of Lockhart in year two, which I know you get to, never underestimate the damage that an incompetent person in a role of authority can do.
Do you just think Dumbledore's like tired? Like if it's year 13, 14,
I'm too
and he,
old
like
for
every
this.
Single year he has freaking turnaround and his staff, he's like, whatever freaking person comes along.
I can't do it anymore. It's too much.
It's like when he's drinking from the cup.
No, no more. No
exactly.
more. I can't stand it.
Yeah, I think he's kind of just like, whatever. This one's going to die too.
But I love, Micah, that you've singled out this Defense Against the Dark Arts problem because, you know, all the stuff that's in The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore is very questionable and problematic, right? Oh, he cozied up to this dictator and was like romantically involved with them. That looks bad. But it doesn't work the same way that watching Dumbledore actively choose year and again to put the students in danger as like maligning his character, like proving that he is making a serious conscious choice to endanger the lives of students is the nail in the coffin. Like Dumbledore has this issue.
Micah chose the like least controversial good person to pick.
I mean, yeah, I'm emphatically telling him how much I like it, but it's true.
Well, I chose a different side of his decision making.
I agree.
But I think it is fair to say he puts the students in danger. Maybe not directly with Quirrell, because Quirrell seems to do a fair job of teaching throughout the course of the year. It's only when Voldemort is revealed.
Yeah.
When he tries to get the Sorcerer's Stone. So outside of Harry, but then again, Voldemort's just like hanging out on Hogwarts campus, right? He's attacking unicorns.
Yeah.
But the thing that cracks me up the most about you saying that Quirrell was like maybe a good teacher is that isn't he the only one that Umbridge is a fan of?
Yeah.
She's like, Quirrell's a good one. And Harry's like, well, Voldemort was there.
One of my faves.
Maybe they dated at some point.
Oh, that's a fanfic.
That's
but
a
don't
fanfic.
You think Dumbledore like could sense that Voldemort was on the back of Quirrell's head? Like, if he can, like, see Harry when Harry's invisible, if he can, like, do legilimens, because he probably can, like, don't you think he could, like, maybe sense that something's going on?
I mean, you have to assume that Quirrell or Voldemort were doing some deep dark magic that could keep Voldemort incognito.
With no body?
Yeah.
I mean, occlumency, yeah, it exists.
That's true.
But I mean, if you're on edge from having to replace the last 11 teachers that held this position.
Tired.
By the time Harry comes around, you have to double down. You have to, like, just keep an eye on Quirrell. And this doesn't rate when he tells Snape, keep an eye on Quirrell, won't you? It's like, you have to do this yourself, Dumbledore. This is nuts.
The parents, the students should have been out front of the Hogwarts gates protesting, saying, we demand change now. Security nightmare. Fix this, Dumbledore. Get it under control.
Starting to sound like a security nightmare.
Security nightmare.
I was waiting for it. I was like, where is it?
Throwback.
Where's the sound?
I needed a break in the fiery conversation. I do like this pick because this one just feels so bad. Dumbledore, again and again, like we've been saying, time after time, continues to let this go. And there's a threat within the school itself. It's pathetic, dare I say.
I mean, how lucky is Dumbledore that nobody died in year two with the basilisk situation? How lucky? Because Voldemort, again, is directly influencing the events in school. And I mean, that's how Myrtle died. It was Dumbledore's fault.
And you have a defense against the dark arts professor who's a complete fraud. You would think that if you had somebody semi-competent, maybe they could have helped resolve the situation much, much sooner. Maybe there is no Ginny getting taken in to the Chamber of Secrets. But again, in terms of vetting the resume, I just think that, yes, Lockhart is clearly a great liar. But to the point made earlier, somebody said, wouldn't it be possible for Dumbledore just to detect Voldemort on the back of Quirrell's head? Shouldn't he know when somebody's lying about their profession?
Maybe he has like an intern that like looks through the resumes first and like, I don't
blaming the intern. Yeah. Classic.
I'm like, maybe Dumbledore doesn't actually vet the teachers and he like hands that off to people now because he's tired.
He should hand it off to the Sorting Hat. The Sorting Hat would immediately be able to see that it's right there in his office. Like,
oh, that'd be fun.
All of his teacher interviews should just be putting the hat on their head. And the hat should be able to see, oh, yeah, no, he was making all that crap up. That's real bad.
That would be smart.
The Sorting Hat on top of Quirrell's turban. Evil!
Eric for headmaster.
Yeah, no thanks. That place is a security risk.
Starting to sound like a security nightmare. Security nightmare!
Just to run through some of these other picks. Lupin, who's a werewolf. That's dangerous in and of itself. I don't care how good of a person he is. Dangerous to the kids.
Ouch. Wow.
It's so true.
So?
No, it's so true.
We'll malign Lupin in like 5 minutes.
Yeah. But he says so at the end of Prisoner of Azkaban, how Dumbledore took a great risk giving him this position. And yeah, he kind of muffed it up. But the point is, again, questionable choice. Is he an effective professor? No question. But is he also a danger to the students? Absolutely.
Even Lupin knows of his own danger. I think that's what is the most terrifying here.
Let us not forget the reason that all that stuff went down outside of the Whomping Willow is because he forgot to take his potion, like the one thing that keeps him safe. And like Snape gave him his potion. But he didn't take it. Like, that's, come on, as wonderful as Lupin is, he's like one of my favorite characters. That is a huge mistake. He could kill people. And he almost does.
Well, and in your upper 30s, like by then he would have formed the habit of taking a potion each month to lessen his symptoms.
This is why I love using Google Calendar to set me some reminders.
Take Wolfsbane potion.
At least around students, because, you know, he might not have always been able to get the Wolfsbane potion when he was out and about, but at Hogwarts he has been able to. And, you know, he really does seem to be genuinely aware of his own danger that he, you know, and genuinely concerned to not let it. That's why he's always missing these classes. He doesn't want to get too close to the full moon and cause any issues, but he forgets to take his potion.
Yeah, but he's also always been a little up for risk. I mean, think about what he did when he was a student. Like, they set him a place where he could go and be safe and, like, also keep everyone else safe in the Shrieking Shack. And then when his friends became anime guy, they all just ran around together while he was a werewolf. And like, that couldn't be the most safe thing either.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he had much of a direct choice. Like, he had a choice. He could have said, no, guys, don't become anime Jedi. But like, knowing who his friends were too, yeah. I think that, you know, a lot of what drives Lupin is this underlying insecurity, which is the idea that without his friends, he would have no friends. And so he allows that to make bad decisions. Basically, his fear of being completely and utterly alone makes his decisions for him.
True.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. Looking at a few of the other professors, Moody or Imposter Moody, Barty Crouch Jr., Death Eater in the school, how does Hogwarts not have a thief's downfall type situation before you even step foot? Nobody should be able to impersonate anybody else stepping foot inside Hogwarts.
That's real smart.
So that's actually the one that bothers me more than any of the others. I know the movie made it so obvious with like the ceiling in the Great Hall.
Yeah, the shifty
that's
eyes.
The most obvious.
The ceiling in the Great Hall. Every time it lightnings when you walk into the Great Hall, you should know that that dude's a bad dude.
I mean, Michael Gambon should have picked up on that. I don't know how he didn't.
Yeah.
Umbridge was a little bit out of his control. Umbridge was forced upon him. But even then, knowing some of what she did to the students, to me, if you are the ultimate person at that school, to let your students be tortured, sorry, dude.
Abused, yeah.
I feel like Dumbledore could have done something. I don't know what, but it's very uncomfortable reading that book and knowing Dumbledore's there, and yet he's not doing anything about this stuff.
It goes back to Dumbledore being lazy about the freaking DADA professors. I'm sorry, but if he had picked someone early enough, we wouldn't necessarily be in this situation, right? Because Fudge intervened and said, well, you haven't like picked someone yet, so it's going to be Umbridge. If he do you think if he had picked someone earlier, they wouldn't be in this situation?
Oh my gosh. Well, yeah. I mean, even going back 4 or 5 years, you're supposed to pick a DADA teacher who stays there for decades, hopefully. So yes, that's a very good point.
And this may be a stretch, right? We talk about how students were tortured or abused in the fifth year, but a student dies in the fourth year, and that's Dumbledore's fault. If Imposter Moody doesn't teach Defense Against the Dark Arts, Harry never gets put into the Triwizard Tournament. And Cedric, maybe he wins, or maybe Fleur wins, or maybe Victor wins. We don't know, because the cup is never hoodwinked.
Why doesn't Dumbledore teach Defense Against the Dark Arts?
Oh, screw it. I'm just going to do it.
Well, right. If he's this all-powerful wizard that can beat this curse, like...
Can he beat the curse?
He's not sure.
He doesn't want to sacrifice himself.
I wouldn't. No, he's too important.
We know he loves setting up a pig for slaughter. Harry.
I'll defend him there. I think, you know, his work with arranging all the other chess pieces, a lot of the problems that are Dumbledore's and a lot of the problems that are Harry's are all Dumbledore's fault. They are all within his control and they are very much his fault. But I also think that at least, you know, Dumbledore wasn't about to put himself in that DADA position for any of those years, because you'd be tempting fate and then he wouldn't be able to actually convey everything he needed to convey to actually bring about Voldemort's death as he eventually does. So I don't blame Dumbledore for not stepping in there himself, but you should at least, if you're going to fall on that sword, at least make educated decisions, smart decisions that ensure the protection of whoever else you're, like your students against whoever else you're putting in there.
And then just wrapping up with Snape, who was put into that position strategically by Dumbledore, knowing that Snape wouldn't last the end of that year. So again, his master manipulation at work. And this is, of course, Harry's favorite subject. And now Harry's sixth year is ruined in Defense Against the Dark Arts, because his worst enemy is now, other than Voldemort, is now teaching the class.
Part of that is Harry's fault. I think, too, like, again, with the Ministry stepping in with Umbridge, Dumbledore generated that animosity between him and Fudge for years, for like a decade or more, for several decades, that was growing. So the fact that the Ministry needed to step in to begin with, like, the whole relationship between the Ministry and Hogwarts, if Dumbledore had been more proactive, they wouldn't have gotten to that point. And with Snape, it's the same thing. Like, Harry could have really grown to like Snape if, one, Snape weren't such an asshole and terrible teacher to students, but two, if Dumbledore had really done more than just said, oh yeah, take classes with Snape, you go do that. If Dumbledore sat in on a single occlumency class, right, actually made sure that the work that was so important was being handled, then Harry's relationship with Snape would have changed too. Like, Dumbledore could have really caused all of that, including the Snape relationship, to be way different, but he didn't.
Can I play devil's advocate for a sec? I'm not a Snape fan. I'll preface this. I do think, though, that he was a good teacher for Defense Against the Dark Arts. I do not think he was a good potions teacher. He would just, like, write instructions on the board and was like, have at it.
Poison toads.
Right. Yeah. But Defense Against the Dark Arts was, like, his passion. And I think that the glimpse in the books that we do see of Snape, he's a much better teacher in that class. And I think that Snape actually taught Harry, well, did teach Harry a lot through Half-Blood Prince, obviously, the book.
Yeah.
And also, honestly, as DA professor, and even Hermione mentions that they're pretty similar when it comes to their view of the dark arts. I'd argue that he was a good teacher in that sense. Abusive, yes, and the way that he treated Neville is like absolutely inexcusable, especially, and Hermione as well, but I'd push back a little bit on that.
But I think the difference too is that he wanted to teach Defense Against the Dark Arts.
Right.
Yeah.
So he was finally getting to do what he wanted to do. And yeah, I agree with you. I thought he was a good professor.
And that curse got him.
Yeah. You know, though, I was thinking this, it would have almost been better if it was Snape that was responsible for the curse, because he was just pissed off at Dumbledore for putting somebody else in all the time.
It's a petty, he's like, you know what? I'm just going to have him die as like my petty little fight. Oh God.
Well, when did we hear that Snape wanted to be the DA teacher? How early was that? Cause I bet there was some
day
first
one
book. Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
One
so, well, there you go. I bet there were some fan theories that he actually was the reason for the curse.
Yeah. I mean, listen, Snape is by far one of the most powerful wizards that we see in the books, and there's no denying that, and he certainly has the capability of doing something like that.
Okay, so I want to talk about Lupin, and specifically his attempt to head out on the road with the trio in Deathly Hallows. So, as everyone probably remembers, he was stressed about the war and the birth of his forthcoming child, who could possibly end up being a werewolf. He was very worried about that. And Lupin decides to ask the trio if he can come along with them to search for Voldemort's Horcruxes. And he admits in the scene, and it's just, it's a very different Lupin when you read this scene. He's cold. He's distant. He admits to the trio that he made a grave mistake in marrying Tonks. Because of his curse, she'll be made to be an outcast, at least so he believes. And Lupin, at one point in the scene, says, I cannot believe that Dumbledore would have disapproved of this idea of me joining you if he appointed me your DADA teacher, after all, which is funny, especially after the discussion we just had. And he also says, I'm pretty sure James would have wanted me to stick with you. Now, Harry absolutely hates this idea and this conversation, and he puts Lupin in his place. And it's probably what most readers were thinking as well. It's shocking to see this adult who's about to have a kid say, hey, can I run off with you three, put myself in danger while I have an expecting mother at home? Harry called Lupin a coward, and things get really tense. Lupin gets physical, throws Harry up against the wall. The whole scene is just really tough to read. And I think there are two big issues here. There's maybe more. First of all, Lupin, of course, wanting to leave Tonks while she's pregnant. Though if I am playing devil's advocate, I'm saying that Lupin understandably didn't trust that three kids could go off and solve everything.
Right.
I can get that.
Yeah. I mean, he's not going to have a family to come back to if these teenagers don't like do everything they need to do.
Oh,
true.
That's
very
a good
true.
Point.
And Teddy could be off for a way worse life if he does live to see Voldemort's reign. But the thing that especially gets me about this is Lupin's physical attack on Harry. And I was thinking about, why did Lupin get so angry? Harry's remarks, I think, enraged Lupin, because Lupin knew that a version of James would have been so receptive to the idea of Lupin coming with James out on an adventure. So I think it kind of just broke his heart to see his best friend's son tell him no, especially in a high stakes opportunity like this. Like, this is literally life or death. And then he gets rejected by his best friend's son. Ooh, that's got to hurt. Still, I don't think any of this is excusable. Because again, read the scene. You don't recognize Lupin. He's in a bad place. Still, shame on him.
It read like I was reading a character from Cursed Child or something when I like read. But no, it's actual Lupin in actual Deathly Hallows.
Lupin is my favorite character in the entire series. And I know people were saying, don't bleep on Lupin earlier in the Discord when we were talking about him as Defense Against the Dark Arts professor. But to me, the problem with this whole scene is that Lupin isn't developed enough as a character through the other books to all of a sudden make him into this character that looks like he wants to run out on his wife and unborn child. And seemingly is trying to be serious by joining up with the trio. Like, it just seems so out of place for him.
That's super interesting. I think that Lupin, I agree with you. I don't know if there's enough backstory there, but if we're going to fill in the blanks a little bit, I think that there's so much trauma that would actually lead to this attack on Harry and this like abandoning his family. You can see it a little bit. Tonks and Lupin are actually my favorite like canonical ship in the entire series, because I think that they're so complicated and I love them together because they're both so powerful and there's so many layers. I just think that Lupin is so guarded because he feels like he doesn't deserve a family, doesn't deserve happiness because of his condition. And that is absolutely so heartbreaking. And I think that this comes from that place of like, well, I don't deserve this family. I don't deserve this happiness. Also, he's not sure what, you know, his child is going to be, a werewolf, like maybe not, who knows? He's so scared. Like, that's what it is. Lupin is so scared and it's really difficult to read and it's absolutely heartbreaking. Again, like, I love Tonks to death, but I think it's coming from a place of like fear. And also
it is,
he's trying to hold on to Harry and to the last bit of James. But I think, you know, earlier when we were saying that, you know, James would have wanted Lupin to come, maybe that's true, but the best part about Harry is that he's nothing like James.
Yeah.
And I think maybe Lupin finally in that moment, like, truly separated them.
Oh,
it's hard for me. And I love more depth to Lupin's character, but I'm just looking at it from the perspective of in Prisoner of Azkaban, he's Harry's real first tie back to his father. And he is the Defense Against the Dark Arts professor in terms of teaching Harry the foundation, because Quirrell didn't do it. Lockhart didn't do it. Lupin was the one who taught him the foundation of everything he needs to know in order to be successful in this series. And so to see then sort of like the human side of Lupin, and I'm not saying he doesn't have his own flaws. Of course he does. And we see it in kind of drips and drabs throughout the series where he's going through this depression, you know, kind of having to go underground. And again, who's he doing for?
Dumbledore.
You know, to try and parlay with the other werewolves. It's just, this is just really hard to read. And I also think in part is influenced by J.K. Rowling and her own experiences of being a single pregnant mother and maybe something similar that happened to her. But to put Lupin in that role, I don't know. I could be wrong, but it's just how I feel.
It's a slow assassination of Lupin's character when you get, I mean, he was my favorite teacher that Harry ever had, still is, if you look at how good he was at it. And a lot of that is knowing the students. He cares about each of the students. He knows each of their quirks. So I feel like the fact that he was largely absent from book 4, book 5, book 6, due to whatever he's doing for Dumbledore, sure. But like, Harry would see him at the Burrow and Harry wouldn't even really walk over. Like, Lupin would be there looking more tattered and ragged than ever. And then that would be like the whole plot of what Lupin is doing in the background somewhere. It's like, no, the fact that he's like showing up and having all these feelings, it feels completely out of left field in Deathly Hallows because we almost don't even know the man anymore.
That's valid for sure. I think it's, you know, never meet your heroes, that sort of thing. Because we put him on a pedestal after Prisoner of Azkaban. And listen, love Lupin, like truly. I just think that actually, maybe I'll take the defense of here. I actually like this, seeing this version of him. It makes him so much more real to me than this perfect teacher. Well, practically perfect besides, you know, the like werewolf thing. It makes him a real human being that you can't put on a pedestal, that makes mistakes just like all the other adults do by the end of this series.
That's fair.
Eric, you said he was slowly assassinated. And then he's actually assassinated.
Oh, God.
So it's like a character assassination. Then she kills him at the end of Deathly Hallows. So
gunned down in an alley. Like, nobody sees it. It happens off screen. It's awful.
I'm just really upset that if Harry didn't say no, Lupin totally would have gone through with this. And then poor Tonks, I think she was with family, but still.
We don't know that.
Well, I think we're led to believe.
He could have maybe spent a few weeks with Harry and then been like, holy shit, this was the wrong decision. I'm going to go back. Like, Lupin, to his core, is a good man. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think he was making a mistake and he was super emotional. That doesn't necessarily mean that he was going to continue on that path. That being said, if Harry didn't say no, maybe Lupin goes with them for a few weeks, helps them get further along, and then becomes like a correspondent. There's like
maybe,
a lot of...
or gets
this
killed.
This is a what if, right? Or gets killed, sure. But he got killed anyway, Andrew.
Fair, yes.
Teddy's an orphan anyway, which sucks.
At least he didn't leave his wife first.
But there were other ways to solve this, though, too. Lupin could have still been helpful to Harry, Ron, and Hermione as they went in search of Horcruxes. He didn't have to be with them. That's also what bothers me about this.
Agreed. Harry also had this line to Ron and Hermione: parents shouldn't leave their kid unless they've got to. And that hits different when it's coming from Harry, an orphan.
But you know what? Here's the thing, right? We talked about Molly. Molly could have taken care of Tonks, and then Lupin could have gone off with Harry, Ron, and Hermione. Problem solved.
Wonderful. All right. Well, Chloe has a big one coming up for us. Hermione.
People are going to come after me for this
one. It's well reasoned.
It's a hot take. Listen, we talked about it. A lot of characters have so much depth to them, and all of these characters, the best part about them is that they make mistakes and they feel real. I chose Hermione. I love her so much. My first gripe with Hermione, and this is actually, again, the author and the way that she writes women and how she feels about certain types of women, or what we consider certain types of women, is this "I'm not like other girls" trope. Have y'all heard of that? No, I can explain it. This idea that the cool girl, the girl that, you know, only hangs out with guys because girls are more drama. She doesn't like pink. She likes sports. Like, she doesn't like traditionally feminine, girly things. And that is really popular and has been really popular since the early 2000s. This idea of like, that girl is better. And if you want to really deep dive into it, it's like, that girl is better because she's not feminine and she's more like into male things, which is a lot to unpack. But you see it in her treatment of Fleur, of Lavender, of Pavarti, like, and her treatment of Luna. She demonizes femininity with Fleur, and like the way that Ginny and Hermione gang up on Fleur is like awful.
It was really bad. Yeah,
it's really bad. It's bullying, to be completely honest. And I don't know if it's out of jealousy or what, but and then also her treatment of Lavender and Pavarti, she absolutely stomps on their like interest of divination because she thinks it's stupid. It's still magic. It's a branch of magic, and it reminds me of like people not liking astrology or thinking it's weird to be into that.
You could expand that to Trelawney as well.
Oh, for sure. She's a teacher. And
that's probably where some of Hermione's hate towards Lavender and Parvati stemmed from. Right. Like, I don't like Trelawney, so I don't like this class, and I don't like that you like this class.
Of course.
It's that common flaw that I think we all have to dislike something that we're not good at. Or dislike something that comes less naturally to us as it does to others. To be like, oh, I'm not good at that, so I'm going to hate on it.
I hate soccer. I hate soccer so much.
And like, oh, you like soccer? Loser. Like, yeah. Ugh.
And not because I never got picked to be on the team.
Exactly, exactly. Andrew perfectly illustrated that whole situation, I think, that's going on with Hermione. So, yeah, she's just awful to Parvati and Lavender about their liking it.
Yeah, and then Lavender's rabbit dying. Reading this, just especially as an adult, is just so frustrating because Hermione is just like not understanding social cues in this situation, but Hermione is literally trying to disprove divination, even though Lavender is crying about her dead rabbit. Like, I think that it's so insensitive, and Hermione can't see past this, you know, the stuff that she doesn't think is fact or she doesn't believe in because it's divination. And like really hurts Lavender's feelings. And it's evident with the way that Parvati reacts, where she's like, leave, like, stop. And then also of Luna in that same vein, you know, Luna obviously believes in a lot of different things. She beats to her own drum. But, you know, Hermione refusing to believe or, you know, shooting down everything Luna says to me cracks me up sometimes because they're in a school of magic. Like, who's to say that it doesn't exist just because you didn't read about it in a book?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially Hermione coming from, you know, she thought she was a muggle for 11 years. Like, you didn't yeah. You didn't grow up with this kind of stuff. Who is she to tell anybody something does or doesn't exist?
Right?
Yeah.
I don't get it. And then talking badly about the Quibbler in front of Luna. Like, Luna's not deaf. She can hear you. That's so
it's
effed
bullying.
Up. Yeah.
It's bullying.
And then my final point with like Luna and just Hermione kind of bullying these other women that she doesn't agree with is how hard is it to say Luna instead of Loony? And all that clues to me is that she was in circles and listening to other people talk about Luna, calling her Loony, meaning that she didn't stand up for Luna in those situations.
Yep.
And she was okay to just listen to people call her crazy. That's not okay either.
Do you think maybe that's because it took some of the attention off of herself?
Ooh. Probably.
Yes.
From a critical, from like a getting made fun of standpoint.
Oh,
that's interesting.
That tracks.
Yeah. I think
it's like, oh, I'm not the one getting made fun of anymore. Time for Loony Lovegood.
Yeah, that's valid. I think all of this comes from a place of trauma. Hermione wants to be taken seriously. I don't think Lavender and Parvati treat her. We don't have instances where they treat Hermione necessarily badly, but I can imagine that they don't, you know, they're not the best of friends. And Hermione might be sad that she doesn't have the women that she lives in her dorm with, you know, as allies.
Yeah. I mean, I guess this sounds bad to say, but you see it happen where the person who has been made fun of for such a long period of time almost turns and appreciates the fact that now there's somebody else who is the one being made fun of. So they're going to join in on it now too, because in their mind, at least, that elevates them beyond the person who's now being made fun of.
That's such a good point.
Sorry, I didn't mean this to go like psych 101, but
no, no, but like when the bullied becomes the bullier, absolutely, because they, you know, they feel it's a place where they can no longer feel small. There's also Fleur, which we talked about already, but it just drives me crazy that for some reason Hermione and Ginny feel as though because Fleur is like feminine, traditionally feminine, that she is only that and there's no substance there. It drives me crazy because if you look at it the opposite, the first three books, Hermione wasn't considered pretty in the books or feminine. And then in the fourth movie, when she finally, you know, goes to the Yule Ball, she, you know, becomes like Harry suddenly like, oh yeah, she is pretty. And then Ron is like super jealous and it's the opposite, right? She does, like Micah, you said, she does the same thing to Fleur, just, you know, the inverse.
And she gets all over Ron, too, for Victor Crumb. But in essence, she's doing the same thing with Fleur.
Oh, yeah. And Lavender later. I wanted to also just bring up, like, briefly Scabbers, just because Hermione just totally disregards the fact that Crookshanks is actively attacking Scabbers. And
yeah.
Yes, Scabbers turns out to be Peter Pettigrew and evil. But before she knows that, she kind of just doesn't care. She's cats will be cats. It's like, dude, but that's his pet.
Cats are an invasive species. It's okay. That's their role.
I just think that that's wild. It's like, you've known Scabbers for, at this point, you know, 2 years. You know that Ron cares about him. Chill.
Yeah, that's mean. You're right. It's like excusing a dog's actions sometimes.
Or it's one of those, my pet would never.
Right. She kind of does do that. She's like, oh, Crookshanks isn't doing that. It's like, yes, she is.
There must be something wrong with your rat, Ron.
Yeah. Well, there was nothing wrong in with this my situation.
Cat. Well, which... right. But at the same time, there's this cat that nobody wanted for years and years and years and years. There's clearly something wrong with Crookshanks, too. So it's like... Hermione just has this savior superiority complex, I think, when it comes to that.
Right, exactly. And then there's, you know, the fact that she kind of dismisses Quidditch, too, as like a stupid thing to be interested in because she's not good at flying. And Ginny, like, you know, lashes out on her in the sixth book, I think rightfully so, you know, because Hermione has all these interests, like in like spew and reading, and she gets made fun of, and that's awful. And I totally don't think that should have happened. But then she turns around and she's like, all you care about is Quidditch. It's like, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, like, this one is bad in my personal opinion.
This is bad. Yeah.
Thank you, Eric, for getting the quote. But Hermione explaining that she didn't care for centaurs in the fifth book after Trelawney is fired by Umbridge. The exact quote, which Eric found, is, not really, said Hermione indifferently, who was reading the Daily Prophet. I've never really liked horses. She turned a page of the newspaper, scanning its columns. He's not a horse. He's a centaur, said Lavender, sounding shocked. A gorgeous centaur, sighed Pavarti. Either way, he's still got four legs, said Hermione coolly. What?
So does your cat.
Yes, but this centaur, like, is complete.
Saved Harry's life.
Saved Harry's life. Like, is a teacher, knows more about divination than she does. Like, it's wild. It's like straight up. I mean,
that's racism.
Yeah, it's racist.
Yeah, I was going to say, we said that during our chapter by chapter that. It's borderline racist.
Yeah, and just especially all her work on spew, it almost doesn't make sense that she would say such a thing.
It makes no sense. It's so out of character, truly.
Yeah.
Especially after being like facing prejudice herself as a muggle-born. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
It's wild. Absolutely wild.
So, yeah.
And then
do you have anything else?
Yeah. I have so much.
This is a long list for Hermione.
I know. Well, people on Reddit kept commenting. I want to run through some of these. They're really, really good, but we'll do quick. That Spyro, or the real Pyro Goth nerd, adds Hermione keeping a woman prisoner in a jar. Like, WTF, girl, that's kidnapping. Okay.
I can't.
Okay. Brownbeard the pirate, Hermione hexing the sign-up sheet for the DA, forcing everyone to sign and not telling them what would happen if they blabbed, is pretty messed up if you step back and think about it. Like, I get it, but damn. To which Pretty Ad 8197 adds, right? I could see if the jinx lasted until the threat had passed or similar, but it appears the girl was permanently disfigured.
Yeah,
it's like, that's psychotic, right?
I think when we were doing chapter by chapter for this area, we called this out too. It was very uncomfortable to see.
I did not realize any of this about Hermione until I reread the books as like an adult, because growing up I just wanted to be Hermione so bad, and I wasn't a Hermione. You know how like you pick a character and you're like, oh, like I'm so much like that person. I wanted to be Hermione, and you know, she inspired me, and then I never was, and I grew up and I was like, you know, maybe some parts of Hermione, not all of it, because she takes it a little too far sometimes. And she also just always thinks she's right. And we all know people like that. We all know a Hermione and we love them, but they have their moments.
There was also this one from Tikanique. Hermione telling Harry there were no animals pulling the carriages in Order of the Phoenix, and Hermione telling Harry there were no voices coming through the doorway. She doubted he was hearing voices in Chamber of Secrets and was proved dreadfully wrong, yet still doubted him in other similar situations. That irked the crap out of me. Yeah.
You know, it just occurred to me, and this feels like a low-key huge revelation, that all these difficult parts of Hermione are her Gryffindor side shining through.
Oh, God.
Just like that righteous kind of like just on
right.
edge Gryffindor, like I'm
hero.
Right, you're wrong, I'm the hero of my story. Like I've often wondered where the Gryffindor side of Hermione is, because I always see her as more of a Ravenclaw, but damn if we didn't like just come across all the Gryffindor parts.
Yeah, listen, I think me choosing Hermione is like also me getting a little vindication. Like there was a lot of girls growing up that bullied me for, you know, being a certain way, and a lot of them were like Hermione, and it's so funny, I wanted to be more like them, but they also were the people that bullied me.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
I think that overall she's like probably the most complex and like just like juicy character. That's a weird thing to say, but it's true. Like it's so much fun to unpack Hermione because she is so like awesome.
We also spend the most time probably with her out of any of the characters, other characters that we've discussed.
So there's more to work with. You're
so there's more
true.
There. Yeah.
I picked a trio member. Yeah. And also
the
female we spend the most time with, you know,
yeah.
like by a lot. Actually.
Yeah, some of these things still could have been cut, though. Some of these are just like, didn't need this. Didn't need this from you, Hermione.
But she was a teenager, too, though. Like, let's
yeah,
not.
You got to keep that in mind. I'm not here to give excuses today. I'm here to criticize everybody.
Ruthless, baby.
It is like, I'm sticking to my job.
Cutthroat.
Next week, we'll be trying to do some defending, actually. This is a nice precursor to next week's episode. Returning to this Reddit thread here, again, the prompt was, what did a character that is considered good do that rubbed you the wrong way in the Harry Potter series? And I think, Eric, you were trying to kind of form a thesis. All the teachers at Hogwarts have rubbed us wrong way. We did hit on a few of them with Micah.
Yeah, there's definitely, this is from a post. It looks like I did not successfully copied the username, so I apologize, but one of the top comments is that every adult in Harry's second year knew that Ron Weasley was carrying a defective wand, and they do nothing. Ron suffers through from day one when they land and the Whomping Willow destroys, you know, his wand in the car. Oh, thank you. It's from Vermilion Eorzean on Reddit. But yeah, from day one, they allow Ron to go through the air. And like, here's this comment. They say, I get that Molly was letting him see the consequences of his actions and was also experiencing financial difficulties, but wands are so incredibly dangerous. Lockhart fried his own brain with the wand. So who is to say that Ron wouldn't have caused himself or others, like Harry and Hermione, severe bodily harm? A simple cutting spell could sever someone's artery. Seamus has simple charms explode in his face with an intact wand. Maybe one of those with Ron with his broken wand might have blown his arm off. Wands aren't cheap, but surely some adult in the school either has access to a spare or can forbid Ron from using magic until he gets a replacement. It's not like he was hiding it. His teachers all knew. So here's my question in that, kind of about the most recent school lunches debates in the US too.
Yes.
Like, wouldn't Hogwarts have a fund for students who can't afford a wand?
100%.
How did Tom Riddle get a wand?
Yeah, this is a school of magic. This is, you have to have the wand to be there. Not to mention, this is going to get dark, but a lot of the adults surely had like siblings or partners that have died that probably had their wands. Like just sitting
at home.
That's
where we're going.
From the first Wizarding World.
Not a donation from the Board of Governors.
Everybody has a spare wand.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, what if Ollivander donated some wands? Doesn't he want to do some good for the community?
I mean, there's this whole thing about the wand has to choose you, but just fly Ron to London one day and have him get a free wand, take one day off, you know, and like, don't make the Weasleys pay. That's just like shady.
Yeah. Or like Ollivander goes to Hogwarts September 1st every year and assists people who need wands.
Perfect.
Boom. Problem solved.
Do you think you only get a free wand at Hogwarts if you're an orphan? Is there some sort of like bar that you need to meet to get, you know, financial aid?
You just need to be a wizard who can't afford a wand.
It's a good idea.
But again, like who's the only situation we know of is Tom Riddle, right? He gets a wand from Hogwarts and his school books.
I had forgotten that.
Yeah, because there's a fund. Why can't Ron tap into this fund?
Go figure.
His FAFSA is not there.
After all the other kids that the Weasleys have sent through Hogwarts, you'd think they would take care of them. But I mean, in the end, it helps because it ends up messing with Lockhart's memory. So,
right.
It is weird that Tom Riddle does get a wand with a core from Dumbledore's bird, like Phoenix. Like,
yeah.
Do you think Dumbledore is just like, oh, the school has a fund that can take, but he's not really going to share the fact that there's no protections for orphan kids or anything. So he just like coaxes Fox to give one of his tail feathers and is like, here, Garrick, fix this.
Oh, interesting. He fashions the wand himself.
Right. Or gets Ollivander to do it.
Speaking of Weasleys, this one is from Avada Kedavra bitch, and they say the Weasley twins' pranks sometimes veered into bullying. If they were Slytherins, they would have been portrayed in a negative light. And I agree with that. If they were Slytherins, they would not have been looked on in the same way as they are as Gryffindors.
And a really good example of this is with the Vanishing Cabinet. They send Graham Montag through it. They push him into it. And he was stuck there for weeks. He couldn't eat, didn't have access to water. He was pushed in there and could have died. And when he did get out, he had to be hospitalized. Harry saw him in the hospital wing. They tortured this guy, threw him in prison.
Listen, there's always a double standard when it comes to Gryffindors versus Slytherins. And because Fred and George were popular and funny and on the Quidditch team and like and attractive, it didn't matter. How often has that happened in high school?
Yeah.
I think, too, though, you remember all of the different products that they were trying out on first years.
Right.
That probably would not have been seen very favorably if they were Slytherins.
Little test rats.
Yeah.
I like Big Mutz said, and this has always bothered me, too, especially reading it or seeing it in the movie. Dobby stopping Harry from receiving any mail at the beginning of Chamber of Secrets. I get why he was doing it and his thought process. His heart was in the right place. But damn, isolating people does nothing good. Oh, Harry was so hurt that nobody was writing to him.
You feel it. You absolutely, yeah. Like, when I was reading that for the first time, I felt as desperate as Harry felt for communication.
So sad. Like,
yeah. Dobby was a villain for, like, a couple of pages there.
Yeah. Well,
Dobby was so annoying in the second book. Listen, I'm sorry. He gets so much better and you learn to love him, but that first book, you're like, come on, just go away.
He was in a hard place.
Pimp My Chase Lounge says Hagrid consistently asking some of the only students who actually respect him to continuously shirk rules and responsibilities to help him with problems that would get any other member of the faculty fired. I know he's a good guy with a big heart, but that's no way to treat your friends. And Impossible Range 854 adds, also the way he ignored Harry, Ron, and Hermione after they told him that they would no longer be taking care of magical creatures. He behaves like an 8-year-old.
Yeah.
And then Impossible says, yes, I know Aragog was also sick in the same time period, but I still don't feel like it's a decent way to behave towards 16-year-olds when you're an adult. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hagrid's got his moments.
Or when Hagrid is like, I know you're not supposed to come out of the castle at dark, and I know it's super dangerous, but can you come anyway? I'm emotional. It's like, dude, you're a teacher.
Hey, no, you should reach out for help. You should reach out to your friends. You should lean on your friends when you're feeling down.
Yeah, but it was so dangerous for these kids to be out. Like, he knew, but because they had the cloak, Hagrid's like, whatever.
Yeah. Maybe they shouldn't have such a close relationship, but that could be a discussion for another day.
Yeah, there's so many times when Hagrid's begging them not to break the rules, though. He's really trying, and they're insisting anyway.
That's true. Oh, yeah, he has his good moments, too, but
Okay,
so that was a lot of fun to discuss today. If you have any feedback about today's discussion, you can send an owl to mugglecast@gmail.com, or you can use the contact form on mugglecast.com. You can also send a voice message. Just record it using the Voice Memo app on your phone and then email us that file, or use our phone number 1-920-3-MUGGLE. That's 1-920-368-4453. And yes, these are all good characters, but everybody has those days. Everybody makes mistakes.
Are you quoting Hannah Montana?
No shame. No shame. That's a good song.
Makes you even better. Love you so much.
This week on Bonus MuggleCast, available on our Patreon, we are going to be gossiping about the early days of our life in the Harry Potter fandom and MuggleNet. We did ask listeners to submit questions they've had about working on the fan site and the podcast over the years. They want to know about how MuggleNet separated from MuggleCast, where other hosts are now, and how did we afford to travel everywhere? Because we sure were doing a lot of it. So this and more in Bonus MuggleCast today on our Patreon. That's patreon.com/MuggleCast. About once a month, we release a new Bonus MuggleCast, and we're trying to get a little more behind the scenes, a little more gossipy, a little more adult in Bonus MuggleCast. And next week on the main show, in defense of part two, Laura will be back and we'll be following up on our discussion that she hosted a few weeks ago. We'll be looking at controversial characters and defend some of their actions. So we're kind of going to turn the tables after what we did today. So lots of fun to be had in the weeks and months ahead on MuggleCast. And now it's time for some quizzage.
Last week's question: who succeeded Albus Dumbledore as Supreme Mugwump of the International Confederation of Wizards? The correct answer was Babajida Akambada. And this is information found in the extended Wizarding World from Potter No More, wizardingworld.com. So congratulations to everybody who got that, including I Like to Jiggle Jiggle Giggle, Kaladin Stormblessed, Advanced Bortion Making, Da Hermione Twin, Buff Daddy, and a very, very, very exited Patreon. And also the Rogue Niffler, Mr. Weasley himself, Must Be Weasley 92, and Seymour Butts going pro in Hogwarts Legacy. Congratulations to all who submitted the correct answer. As always, you can submit that over the MuggleCast website, Quizzitch form, MuggleCast.com/Quizzitch. Here is next week's question. In book canon, according to book canon, what color is Firenze the Centaur's hair?
Purple.
And submit your answer to us over on the MuggleCast website. Thanks.
Couple other reminders. Make sure you're following the show for free in your favorite podcast app. Just hit that follow button and leave us a review if they allow you to. And don't forget to follow us on social media, especially this week, because Chloe's here. She did such a great job today.
She did. Thank you, Chloe.
I love being on, y'all.
I almost said she's MuggleCast. We are MuggleCast on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. Why don't you give us a quick tease? What can they expect, Chloe, when they follow us?
I was about to say, you're not wrong. She is MuggleCast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok.
That's true.
You can expect a lot of fun, nostalgic content. You can expect clips from the pod. You can expect memes. You can expect all of our faces. And I'm pretty good at responding, so let's talk Harry Potter.
You are. Chloe, you do such an amazing job. We're so lucky to have you here.
Stop.
Also, she shares a lot of great TikToks on MuggleCast.
I've curated some good Harry Potter TikToks. If you're a fan of Draco Talk, those two. But yeah, come follow us. It's a good time.
It is. It really is. Thank you again, Chloe, for joining us today. It was great having you, and we will get you on with Laura in the future.
My girl. Laura, I love you if you're listening. Miss you.
We love her, too. We love her, too. All right, well, that's it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I'm Andrew.
I'm Eric.
I'm Micah.
And I'm Chloe.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.